morning, everyone, and welcome to the Cool Project Show, where we showcase projects from around the world. I'm your host, Michelle Molyneux, and today we have Rick Allen, founder of Natalis Productions, North Carolina. Rick is a broadcast video producer and cinematographer and has been producing documentaries and shooting videos since 1983. So today, we're going to learn about the exciting and various projects that Rick has worked on. Rick, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, Rick, I always ask people, let's begin with your background. And how did you get into broadcast video production?
It's kind of a long, twisted story. What happened when I got out of high school, I went to school at NC State University. And I went into aerospace engineering. But after about three semesters of chemistry and calculus and physics, and at best being a C student, I decided that that probably was not the thing for me, even though I had a huge interest in science and engineering and technology. And I wasn't happy in the engineering field. And the other thing was that if you're building an aircraft, you really don't want to see a student building your aircraft for you. So I decided it was time for a change. So when I was 12, I actually started in little theater, children's theater, and was always involved in the behind-the-scenes work, lighting and sound and building sets and that sort of thing. And then in high school, worked with the drama club and did the lighting for the plays and AV sorts of things. And so literally when I was at NC State, I went to the catalog and went down through the different majors and things that were available to me outside of engineering and got speech communications. And then the subset was telecommunications, which is radio and television. And I went, gee, that sounds like me. That's something that I would be interested in. So in the middle of my sophomore year, I switched from engineering to telecommunications, and pretty much from then on, I knew that I had done the right thing. And so that degree is what started me along the way. While I was a student, I worked for North Carolina Public Television on their student crew because at that time they had a facility in Raleigh, North Carolina. So we would, the students would crew the shows, run cameras, lights, teleprompter for some of their shows. Got a job out of college working for a local UHF television affiliate, an independent station. And that was a really wonderful experience because at a small UHF station, you don't get hired to do just one job. And by the time I left that station after about 2 years, I had cycled through about every job there was to be done on the technical side of the TV station, from running cameras for a newscast to doing audio and field production, commercial production, and eventually directing the newscast. And I even ran master control, which is the main output for the station, so that everything that goes out on the air goes through you. And so it was a great, great experience because I got my hands on pretty much every piece of equipment that existed in television in the late 1980s. And from there, moved on, switched to shooting news, worked for an ABC affiliate in the mountains of North Carolina, then came back closer to Raleigh and worked for two network affiliates, an ABC and a CBS affiliate, for about 8 years. And then finally in 1997, decided that I really wanted to work for myself and create my own production company. And so set out to do freelance work for the networks, for History Channel, National Geographic, Discovery, PBS, things like that, focused on military and especially underwater because I love to scuba dive. And so I believe I told you the rest is history, and that's really how I'm doing what I'm doing now.
Wow, that's amazing. What kind of military productions were you doing?
We've done all sorts of work for the military. Some of it is external, where we cover military activities. When I was in television news, I traveled to Egypt and Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Cuba with the 82nd Airborne to cover their activities. And then once I started my own production company, we've done work, training, and internal communications for the military, some things for special forces, new systems in the military. So a big branch of things. And also when contractors need video production work when they come to Fort Bragg or go to some other military base, because we have that expertise working with the military and know the language, it's very helpful, and we often get hired to assist them with their work. So,
well, was it easy for you to do that transition from starting up your own production company?
I think at the time there was some planning that went into it, because I started my own company at the end of 1997. But for about a year and a half, I'd been planning to move into the freelance business and start my own company. And so I worked weekends and did other freelance on my off time and took all that money and saved it to buy gear. So I don't think it was that difficult at the time, because when I got to the point where it was time to leave, I pretty much had to make a choice, because I was doing so much work, freelance work, in my off time from my main job. And I really had to make a decision as to whether I was going to work for me or continue to work for the television station at the time. And so it was pretty easy to make that move. You also have to remember, in 1997, there was a pretty significant investment in equipment. Just to buy a good television camera would be $50,000 or something like that. So it was a big change. And it's not like now where you can go out and buy an HD camera for several hundred dollars and start your own production company. So it was a significant investment in time and money, but it was the right thing to do at the right time, and I've never looked back.
And how did you start attracting and getting some of the projects that you've worked on?
Yeah, early on, before the advent of the power of the Internet, you really would work just through contacting people, production companies, other production companies that did work for Discovery or Geographic, and tell them that you existed and what your expertise was. There are also crewing services that contract with you, and so they get a percentage of your fee. And so I got on with a couple of major crewing services. So let's say Aetna or Bayer or Pepsi or something was coming to your area and needed a production crew, they would call up the crew service, and the crew service would contact me, and then I would do the work for them. And so it was that sort of thing. And then after a few years, it becomes word of mouth. You know, you develop clients, and they're happy with you, and they call you back. Or, you know, you find other people that you meet on jobs, and you network with them, because we really didn't have the power of the Internet and web pages in the late 90s to do that. So it was old school, as it were.
And now it's so much more easier.
It is easier, but it's also more complex, because there's so many more people who have a presence out there in the world. And I think it's a little harder actually to separate the people with the talent and skills from people who say they do a certain thing. And I think it's the hard part for people who are hiring people like me, freelancers right now, to separate folks with actual skills and experience from people who have impressive-looking websites but may or may not have done a whole lot.
So now give me an idea of how long does it take to actually work on a specific project, whether it's a documentary, you know, compared to a corporate video that you have to do?
Oh, wow. It can vary. I mean, the time it takes for a project is really dependent. There are some jobs we get that are only a day. You know, the client may have, something where we need to go and shoot video for them. We hand the video over, and they are gone. There are other projects that may literally take a year or more. In the case of the Mardi Gras project, which we'll talk about later, that was over 14 months. The Queen Anne's Revenge Shipwreck project, which I work on, has been ongoing since 1998. So some things are long-term and some things are short-term. And as with all things, the client may need it yesterday, and you have to make that happen. So,
right. And how many in your company?
My company is just me, and I size up or down depending upon what we need. Because I work in the freelance world, I don't have to be an expert on everything. I just have to know somebow who is. And so I've got very good contacts in the business who who have all the different skill sets that I may need. And so if I need additional cameramen or producers or writers or graphic artists or that sort of thing, then I will contact them and bring them on for the length of the project. And they'll do the same for me. So especially where I live in North Carolina, the freelance community is strong and gets along fairly well, and we work together to pass jobs around and assist each other whenever possible.
Right. And do you do your own editing as well?
I do. I'm an editor and producer and director. I do not write. That is a skill that I don't have. And I have the greatest respect for writers and people who can be wordsmiths. So that's one of the things I don't do. But most of the other jobs I'm fairly fluent in and have good, strong backgrounds in. So
let's talk about some of the projects that you've actually been working on. You know, just going through your website, it's like, wow, you've done a lot. So let's start with, what was the SWAT? There was one that I thought was about a SWAT team, like doing a, following a SWAT team.
Oh, back in the good old days. And that actually, when I was in television news, and this was back in the early 90s, we used to be able to go with law enforcement, and whenever they do drug busts and that sort of thing, they would sometimes let television crews come along. And this is even predates the show Cops on television, which goes back quite a ways. But
wow.
Whenever drug busts or that sort of thing, they would allow you to go along. And so it was always funny, though, because I'd be standing in the back of a dark van as we're driving down the road, and there's a bunch of very big deputies who are in full SWAT gear with helmets and bulletproof vests and automatic weapons on, and all I've got on my shoulder is a camera, and I'd be like, hey, how come you guys get that? And they're like, oh, don't worry about it. Just stay behind us, and everything will be okay. And at that time, you could literally go through the door with them. And so you would be the last guy in line, and as the SWAT team went through the door, you'd follow them behind and hope that nobody was shooting. But there were moments when you kind of just thought, what am I doing? This is without a doubt the craziest, maybe dumbest thing I've ever done, because sometimes people do shoot back. But it did actually, it worked out, and it was I was young, and it was very exciting. And but eventually, you know, that went away for safety issues and privacy issues with some of the people and that sort of thing. So there was a period there where that was a very interesting part of my life, to say the least.
Well, that's amazing. Well, what we're going to do is take a quick break from get a word from our sponsors on America's Web Radio, and we'll talk more with Rick and his adventures and some of the amazing projects right after these messages. We'll be right back.
The disease of addiction is a life-altering challenge, not just for the person suffering its effects, but also for the family and friends who support and love the one caught in its grasp. What should be the course of treatment? Who is the best person to render treatment? And what is the best place to go for the care that is needed? We know that you want answers to these and many more questions. Call 770-696-9862 and speak to a representative of the Atlanta Healing Center. They can tailor a program specifically designed to address the needs of the person suffering with an addiction, or give you guidance as to where that help may be found. Information is the key, and the trained staff at AHC is here to assist. If you wish, you can also get more information on the website located at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
45 years of experience is behind the most trusted name in auto transportation. Passport Transport, the first and finest today. That's why Passport Transport is the preferred auto transport for major auto manufacturers, concours, museums, tours, and collectors, and should be your choice from across the state to across the country. When you have the need, go to PassportTransport.com and enjoy the peace of mind referenced experience will give you. Passport Transport.
You're listening to America's Web Radio.com. the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Cool Project Show, and today we're talking with Rick Allen, cinematographer, producer of documentaries, and an all-round adventurous guy. Rick, we were just talking about how you got into doing video productions. How did you get into underwater cinematography?
Well, that's a really interesting story. As a child, I grew up watching Jacques Cousteau every Sunday night and couldn't wait for the specials that would come on TV. I grew up in West Texas, which is about as far from the ocean as you can get. But I was always fascinated by the ocean, and my dad was a biologist. And whenever we'd go to the beach in the summer for vacation, we'd always spend a lot of time playing around the piers and poking under rocks. And he loved the ocean, too, and I think that carried over. And there was always a part of me, like a lot of young people at that age, that wanted to grow up and be Jacques Cousteau. And so that was always kind of in the back of my mind of something that was interesting to me and something I'd love to do. And I grew up in the water. I probably learned to swim before I could walk. My dad had me in the pool swimming well before I was any good at walking or anything like that. So the water has always been home to me. So I worked my way through college as a lifeguard. And when I was in school, one of the physical education classes you could take was scuba diving. Before college, I couldn't afford it because the class was too expensive, but I could take it for a PE, and I'm like, oh, I am going to do that. So I had this wonderful scuba instructor named Larry Brown, who is a legend in our part of the world. And Larry's just, he was a former Navy SEAL and one of the coolest cookies I've probably ever met in my life. And if you're in a difficult spot, he's the guy you want having your back. But he was always funny because in class, I went to an engineering school. And if he wanted a desk move, he'd look around the room and go, who's a mechanical engineer? He said, and find out who that was, and he'd have the mechanical engineer move the desk. And if he wanted a light switch turned on, he'd ask the electrical engineer to turn the switch on. And so it went. And so Larry, my instructor, had one of the very first underwater video systems that recorded on VHS tape. And he was using it to record the swim team, and also to start to document his scuba dives. And this is in the early 80s, 83. So we were going on some of our first sets of scuba dives. And he looked at me and said, you're the speech major, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And he said, okay. And he handed me the underwater video camera. Pretty much from then on, I was the video guy for the class and kept doing it. And it also dovetailed with my telecommunications degree. And so they just really kind of came together at the same time. Shooting and producing video above the water and below it all happened together just because I was a speech major, and so he handed me the camera.
I was really intrigued to hear, and I want to hear about Blackbeard's Queen Anne Revenge Ship. How did you land that project?
Well, for the people who don't know, Blackbeard the pirate sunk his flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, off the coast of North Carolina in the summer of 1718. And when he did that, he had approximately 4 vessels under his control and about probably 300 pirates or so. But Blackbeard at the time had not paid his crew. They hadn't taken any prizes in a while. And so they were not happy. They didn't have any money in their pockets. And so what I like to call the first case of corporate downsizing in the New World happened. And Blackbeard ran his flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, aground on a sandbar off of Beaufort Inlet, North Carolina. And then he ran another one of his sloops, the Adventure, aground at the same time. And then he took off with about 2 other sloops and about half the pirates and marooned the first half. So he cut his crew and his payroll in half in one day. So in 1996, a treasure hunting company called Intersound, which is working under a permit with the state of North Carolina, found a big pile of cannons and anchors and ballast stones about a mile from Beaufort Inlet. And they had an idea that they might have Blackbeard's flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge. And so they arrested the wreck and eventually handed over the wreck to the state of North Carolina and traded that for replica rights and media rights on the shipwreck. And that happened in early 1998. So about the same time, North Carolina Public Television wanted to do the first documentary on the finding of the shipwreck and the very first archaeological season which occurred in the spring and summer of 1998. And so North Carolina Public TV hired me to follow the project and work underwater and document the work that was going on there for that documentary. And to say that it was fascinating to dive on a real pirate ship in what is literally my backyard would be an understatement. But I made sure that when I was there that not only was I the guy with the camera, but I helped with lines and helped people assemble their gear, and just made every effort to be useful beyond just being the guy with the video camera. And then the next year I came back as a volunteer and pretty much have stayed on the project since then. I entered into an agreement with Intersal, which found the wreck and had the media rights. And so we came up with a contract wherein whenever I licensed footage from the shipwreck to BBC or Discovery or PBS or whoever, that they would get a percentage of my sales and licensing, and I would stay as the official project videographer. And that's pretty much continued since 1998. And it's what we all call real adventure, because you have that amazing moment when you're lying on the bottom of the ocean and the sand's moving back and forth, and you'll watch a plate or a spoon or a cannonball or a cannon or any other artifact, like an onion bottle, which was the wine bottle at the time, and it literally just comes up out of the sand. You know that you're one of the first people in almost 300 years that's seen that artifact. And it gets to touch it. And it's very possible that the last person to touch that was Blackbeard or a member of his crew. And so you have a very real connection to what was, to me as a child, a legend, except that now this legend is real. And you're writing history as you speak and in that moment. And having the opportunity to document that history in real time and be a part of that is something that I'll not forget. I'll always remember, and it's something I'm very proud of.
Are they still doing exploration for more artifacts of Blackbeard?
Yes, currently about 60% of the Queen Anne's Revenge has been excavated. There's still another 40% or so left. The wreck is buried under 2 to 4 feet of sand. Right, and so in order to recover artifacts, you have to go in with what's called induction dredges, which are basically giant underwater vacuum cleaners. And so you have to suck the sand off the area you're working on, and you put down a grid that's 5 feet by 5 feet, and you take pictures of what's in the grid and measure everything, and every artifact you find gets a tag on it. And it's a very methodical process. But you can imagine that if you've ever dug a hole in the sand at the beach, you know, the sides slide in. And so when you dig a hole in the sand underwater, it's 10 times more difficult. And so to dig a hole that's 2 or 4 feet deep, you may have to create an area that's 20 feet in diameter with these giant vacuum cleaners. And so it's a very physical labor, but it is, and it's also, you know, when you watch documentaries, you see all this beautiful clear blue water and that sort of thing. We often work in conditions where the visibility may only be 1 to 3 feet or less than a half meter. And you sometimes can't even see your hand in front of your face, and you're working by feel. So imagine documenting artifacts from a 300-year pirate ship in the pitch black. And you get it with a current running and ocean waves moving over you and making you surge back and forth. It can be pretty challenging, both physically and mentally, because you are working in the dark.
And how deep is the site?
What's really interesting about the Queen Anne's Revenge, when it ran aground, it hit a sandbar. And over time, that sandbar has eroded. And so the wreck site itself is only about 24, 25 feet deep. And then the next, like you say, several feet of sand beneath that. So the maximum depth that we hit is only about 28 feet. And we're only a little over a mile from shore. So it's not that far at all. And it's not, as scuba diving goes, it's not deep. But you're in a working environment. There's lines around. There's entanglement hazards. You've got big hoses coming down. So you do have to be careful, and you do have to be aware, and you do have to work with people who are very, very good at what they do. And I'm always amazed by the skill of the archaeologists that they can do what they do and so methodically and carefully and accurately map these shipwrecks under what would be difficult conditions for any diver, much less these guys. So,
and how long do you go down there for each dive then?
It depends on how hard you're working, but an average dive is about an hour. And so in a day, the archaeologists and technicians may do 2 to 4 dives. I will normally do 1 or 2, and I'll generally stay an hour and a half per dive because I'm not physically exerting myself as much as they are. I'm sitting there and just documenting and recording what they're doing, so I'm not having to exert myself as much as they are.
That's a lot of film footage that you've done.
Well, it's, what is it now, 18 years, something like that. It's quite a library. It's over 100 hours of footage right now.
Do you know how many pieces of artifacts they've retrieved so far? I mean, you said 60%.
It's, the last number I read was, I think, over 250,000 artifacts. So, but that also includes a lot of it could be is lead shot. So if you start counting individual lead shot, the number goes up pretty quick. But it is in the hundreds of thousands of artifacts. And so it's a pretty amazing collection, for sure.
Is that being held at a museum or, like, as an exhibit?
Yes, right now you can see some of the most interesting artifacts at the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Beaufort. That is the main public area to see them. And then the rest of the artifacts are held at the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab, which is on the ECU. East Carolina University campus in Greenville, North Carolina. And those sometimes are available to the public. They'll have open houses periodically throughout the year when you can go and see more of them.
Do you know if there'll be other Blackbeard ships, or that's just the main one that has run aground?
Right now, the Queen Anne's Revenge is the only shipwreck that has been found from his fleet. But his other sloop that he ran aground, the Adventure, has not been found. And it should be, according to the records, very close, because they used the Adventure to try and catch the Queen Anne's Revenge off the bar. And what that means is they ran a line out to one of the large anchors and dropped it down in the sand and tried to use their windlass to pull the Queen Anne's Revenge off the bar. And in that case, they got the Adventure stuff, too. And so there should be the remains of that sloop within, according to the records, a gunshot of the Queen Anne's Revenge. And that has not been found yet. But it, too, is a wooden ship, and it's unclear as what would be on there, like cannons or that sort of thing. Because once the ships ran aground, Blackbeard had plenty of time to...
When four members of Congress all die within 4 months, each of their deaths appears to be from natural causes. But when mysterious messages begin to appear in the form of quotations from long-dead revolutionary heroes, one reporter sets out to prove the existence of a serial killer. His search discovers dark secrets and an assassin shielded by people who need the very services that only he can provide. The Sun Silas Rising, a novel by Doug Dahlgren. On Kindle or paperback through Amazon.com.
Whether cruising the strip in a 57 Chevy or taking the family on a vacation in a 71 Oldsmobile Vista Cruiser, you need to tune in to Classic Cars with Steve Ronaldo and Jim Weber every Saturday from 8 to 9 a.m. on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
Perhaps you are struggling to cope with the disease of addiction. If not, you probably know a family member or friend that needs help in battling the cravings and the personal and professional damage done by the effects of drugs or alcohol. Get a pen and paper and be ready to write down the following. These are the issues that the trained staff at the Atlanta Healing Center address and treat every day. Their doctors and counselors with over 40 years of practice in the field of addiction can treat the suffering individual in a thoughtful, compassionate, and experienced manner and guide him or her along the path to recovery. So call 770-696-9862 and speak to a knowledgeable staff member about how you or your loved one can be helped to enjoy a better and healthier life. More information is also available on the website at www.atlantahealingcenter.com.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Cool Project Show, and we've been talking to Rick Allen about various projects, especially we just learned about the Black Bears Project. Now, I'm very intrigued with the Mystery Mardi Gras Shipwreck documentary. Can you tell me a little bit about that one, too?
Well, that's one of those crazy things that happens in my business. In the fall of 2006, on a Wednesday, I get a phone call from a gentleman named Peter Hitchcock from Texas A&M University. And this was actually on a Wednesday afternoon. And he says, we want to do a documentary about a shipwreck in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's 4,000 feet deep. And we need to do this in the next, I don't know, 5 months, 6 months, something like that. And, oh, by the way, I've got to present the proposal for this documentary to a committee tomorrow.
Oh, my.
Are you interested?
Oh, wow.
So we chatted for a bit, and it became clear that he was absolutely serious and that he was legitimate. And so I literally had 24 hours to put together a plan to document activities on a 4,000-foot deep shipwreck that would take about 3 weeks of offshore time, and the whole project was probably going to cost about six figures, and I had to turn that into him with a proposal the next day. And so I did what all good documentary filmmakers did. I pulled out a template I had for a project I'd done for National Geographic several years before, and started plugging in numbers and writing, and stayed up late. The next morning, he had a proposal to create a one-hour documentary on what became the Mystery Mardi Gras Shipwreck. And without a doubt, this is probably one of my most favorite projects that I've ever been involved in, and it's something I'm extremely proud of. And whenever you sit around with other people in this business, you tell stories about what you did and the generally the hardships that you faced in doing something. And so this project always comes up when we do that. So you have to remember that we had to come up with a way to document work on what's called a dynamic positioning ship. And this is a 250-foot long ship that literally hovers over a certain spot in the Gulf of Mexico and can maintain station within about 1 meter. And work on these ships goes on 24/7. Because the ship itself costs about $100,000 a day to lease. And in order for the archaeologists to work, they had to work 24 hours a day to maximize their time. And so we had to figure out how to have enough crew to cover 24 hours a day for a three-week period. And technically, this was hugely challenging because we're offshore. We're, let me think, about 20, 25 miles from the coast. We have to be totally self-contained. We have to figure out a way to record what became over 300 hours of footage, and about 240 of that was from underwater. And we had to have, because of the way the ship was laid out, the pilots and the remotely operated vehicle operators, the ROV operators, were in a shack that was on the back deck. One of those 10 by 20 foot containers, and the archaeologists were in another room, in the control room, which was up on the bridge of the ship. And they were separated by five decks and about 100 feet of linear space. And so we had to be able to be in both places at once, as well as record footage from the ROV, which was the underwater robot that they were using to survey the shipwreck site. And from technically, it's probably one of the most challenging things I've ever done. Physically, it was challenging. Emotionally, it was challenging. Just everything about the shipwreck project just screamed the potential for failure. And as it turned out, that didn't happen. and it turned into a really amazing project.
So basically you were, it sounds pretty amazing. It was recovering the artifacts. Were you also raising the ship as well? Or is that what they were trying to do?
No, what happened, the Mardi Gras shipwreck was actually found during a oil and gas survey in the Gulf of Mexico several years prior. And it was decided that at some point there would be an archaeological survey of the wreck site because it had been disturbed during that oil and gas survey when they wanted to lay a pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was, at the time, the first deep water archaeological survey of a shipwreck in the Gulf of Mexico. It had never been done before. So the archaeologists from Texas A&M University and the archaeologists from what is now the Bureau of Ocean and Energy Management got together and came up with a plan to use this underwater robot, the ROV, to survey the wreck site, which means take pictures of everything, document everything they could find, and then recover a few artifacts that would be useful for dating the shipwreck and would give them some context and some information about what the shipwreck may be. And as part of that, during the ROV survey, one of the things that was found was a very unique stove from the period, which turned out to be right around the early 1800s, maybe pre-war of 1812, during the war of 1812 time period. There were bottles, there were plates, there was even a big cannon that we recovered that was about 8 feet long and was incredibly heavy. And this wreck had been laying on the ocean floor for, since the early 1800s. And so it was fascinating to be part of that process because, you know, you had the ROV operators who were really guys that came from working in the oil and gas fields. And so they're really can-do guys. And without a doubt, some of those creative engineering problem solvers that I've ever met in my life. And then you also have the archaeologists, very methodical, and have a very systematic approach to what they want to do. And you've got this time period where we only have 3 weeks, and we've only got 24 hours a day in those 3 weeks to do as much work as we can do. And so it was challenging in so many ways because of the pressures on everybody in the crew to do a good job and get as much done as they could. And at one point, the ROV technicians needed to lift up this stove, which is about the size of a big cooler, to give you an example. And it's also been on the bottom of the ocean for, you know, over 100 years, so it's not in great shape. And so they rigged a fiberglass stepladder to the front of the ROV and figured out how to scoop up this stove and put it on the front of the ROV and bring it to the surface from 4,000 feet without destroying it. And so it was just a lot of fun to watch the problem solving and to be a part of that and documenting the creativity and the care with which everybody went into recovering these artifacts. So just a great, great project. And the whole thing took from beginning to end, starting in about May of 2007 when we went out, to July of 2008 when I delivered, well, when I finished shooting the documentary, because we had to document the recovery of the artifacts. We had to do interviews with all the experts about what was going on and all of that. And then we had to go back to the conservation lab at Texas A&M and interview the experts there after some of these artifacts have gone through conservation and been cleaned up, and they really know what they have so that we can see the before and the after. And that took about 14 months of production time. And so it was just, it was a long process, but it was really fascinating. And those artifacts are now at a museum in Baton Rouge, and the public can go see them there. But from the Department of Difficult Things I've Done department, that would definitely rate as in my top three.
Right. And approximately how many artifacts did they retrieve?
That would be tough to say. I don't have the exact number.
Yeah.
I think it would probably be in the dozens. And once you broke something, maybe over 100, but not a whole lot. And the occupancy was not, as it turned out, this is probably a fairly small vessel, maybe 35, 40 feet in length. It probably carried a couple of guns, and it might have been a privateer, a gun runner, somebody at the time who was running arms to any of the different nations involved in the War of 1812 at the period. We did find a chest, a gun chest on board, but weren't able to recover it, that had a bunch of muskets and pistols and that sort of thing in it. And so all the artifacts pointed at that time period. But once again, I seem to have been involved in a shipwreck that involved pirates or privateers or some sort of illicit or possibly illegal activity. So it seems to be a theme in what I do.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of shipwrecks in that area. Is it easy to find shipwrecks? Or
in the Gulf of Mexico, they do stumble upon shipwrecks fairly easily because of the oil and gas industry. They have areas that are leased, and they have, I believe it's 3 square mile blocks. And so anytime an oil or gas company wants to explore or drill in those leased blocks, they have to do an underwater survey. And that's usually done with ships on the surface using side scan sonar, which is essentially underwater radar. And whenever they find an anomaly or something that's interesting, then an archaeologist has to actually put eyes on it and take a look at whatever that signature was from the bottom. So they'll get an ROV and do some sort of survey to see what's there. And sometimes it's just old containers that have fallen off ships. It's equipment, coils of wire. But not uncommonly, it can be a shipwreck. It can be modern or World War II or hundreds of years old. And if you think about the amount of commerce that went on in the Gulf of Mexico over the last hundreds of years, the potential for shipwrecks and because of hurricanes and that sort of thing is extremely high. So basically, if you go look long enough, you'll find something.
You have some other projects called B-25?
Yeah, I was actually working for a show called Mega Movers on the History Channel. And I got called because they were in the area. They were looking at a B-25 that went down during World War II, crash landed in Lake Murray in South Carolina, which is outside of Columbia. And they were going to do an episode on Mega Movers about the recovery of this B-25 from the lake. And so I got a call to provide crew for that. So I hired one of my sound guys. And so we worked with another crew that was from the History Channel.
Your auto love and investment demands the best, and for 45 years, Passport Transport has been meeting those demands. From manufacturers to the one-car collectors and all other facets of the auto industry and antique auto hobby. The first and the finest with unequaled service and peace of mind. Passport Transport, your auto transportation company. Contact PassportTransport.com with your need today. Passport Transport.
Are your health insurance premiums going up? You are not alone. Visit us at ObamacareWatch.org to understand why and what you can do to get us back on the right track. This is Grace Marie Turner, president of the Galen Institute. Visit us at ObamacareWatch.org.
When four members of Congress all die within 4 months, each of their deaths appears to be from natural causes. But when mysterious messages begin to appear in the form of quotations from long-dead revolutionary heroes, one reporter sets out to prove the existence of a serial killer. His search discovers dark secrets and an assassin shielded by people who need the very services that only he can provide. The Sun Silas Rising, a novel by Doug Dahlgren. On Kindle or paperback through Amazon.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the Cool Project Show. And we've been talking with Rick Allen, a documentary producer and underwater cinematographer. We've been talking about B-25.
Yeah, that was another one of those incredibly challenging events because the days were long. They started early in the morning. We'd work well into the night. You're recovering artifacts from a shipwreck or an aircraft or anything like that, there's always time pressure and there's always money pressure because every day that you work costs the people who are doing the work a lot of money. And so they were trying, you know, as efficiently as possible to recover an intact B-25 from Lake Murray, which had sunk or had crash-landed during a training mission. And luckily, everybody on the crew had survived. But this aircraft had been at the bottom of Lake Murray, 150 feet deep since World War II. And again, it was just incredibly challenging diving conditions because the water was cold at the bottom, temperatures in the 50s. And in South Carolina, you have this wonderful red Georgia clay. And everything on the bottom of the lake was this very fine red clay, and there was about a foot of it on top of the aircraft. And so every time you even touched the aircraft, this stuff would billow up, and you could not see your hand in front of your face. And so it was dark, and it was cold, and it was dangerous because there are lines going down to the aircraft, and there's a real risk of entanglement, and you can't see which way is up. You can't feel which way is up. It's just, without a doubt, one of the hardest things I've ever done. But, again, also very fulfilling because eventually the wreck did come up. We did get the aircraft to the surface, and I was able to shoot pictures of it both on the bottom and as it arrived just below the surface. And eventually became a really interesting and popular episode on Mega Movers.
Wow, that's amazing. And where is it now? Where is it being stored now?
Right now, the remains of that aircraft are at the Southern Museum of Flight in Birmingham, Alabama. But the aircraft was in such bad shape when it came to the surface, they had hopes that they were going to fully restore it. But I don't think they were able to do that. So they've restored pieces of it, put those on display.
I did one project called the Kill Zone. Can you tell us about it?
Oh, that's another one of my favorites. Pretty much, I'm into two things, sharks and shipwrecks. And in the early 2000s, I met a gentleman named Aidan Martin, who has since passed, and he's a shark researcher. He was very interested in the great white sharks of False Bay, South Africa, because these sharks breach or jump out of the water while chasing their prey in South Africa. And it's one of the few places in the world where they do this regularly, and he wanted to do a documentary about it. And I had met him at a diving conference, and he convinced me that this was a good idea and I should go do it. So in 2000 and 2001, I took a crew to False Bay, South Africa, and we spent a total of about a month over the two time periods documenting 14 and 16-foot, 2 and 3,000-pound great white sharks who jump completely out of the water while trying to kill seals, which are their primary food source. And so we get up early in the morning and go out on this little tiny boat and troll around this place called Seal Island, which had about 60,000 seals on it, and wait for a great white to go after a pod of seals that might be coming in or going out to or from feeding. And one of the things I remember about very early on in that, whenever you get on a boat, there's always a safety brief. And, you know, the captain tells you about where the fire extinguishers are and the radio and the life jackets and all the equipment and things you should do in the case of an emergency. And so when we were in Seal Island, our guide said, gave us the briefing and explained about the radio and the Coast Guard and that sort of thing. And after the briefing, he'd left something out. And we looked at him and said, hey, what about the life jackets? What if we need a life jacket? He said, oh, don't worry. It won't help. And the point being that if you fell overboard here, you weren't going to need a life jacket because you weren't going to be alive long enough to worry about it. And so that kind of pretty much set the tone for the rest of the adventure. And it really was amazing because you'd get out at sunrise and you would follow a group of seals coming into the island. And a few hundred yards before they reached the island, they would dive down and go straight to the bottom and swim along the bottom so they could come up right by the island. Because the great white sharks would circle the island close to shore and wait for the seals to surface, and then they would hit them from underneath because the seals couldn't see them because they were down in the dark water in the early morning. And so you'd follow a group of seals coming in, and then all of a sudden there would just be this explosion, and this giant shark would come up out of the water and attack these seals, and then you would follow what happened after. And sometimes the seals got away, and sometimes they didn't. And then after an hour or so of that, The sun would start to get a little higher, and it would be harder for the sharks to sneak up underneath the seals. And so then we would put out a decoy behind the boat, and we'd take a boogie board, an old boogie board that was roughly shaped like a seal or a piece of carpet or pretty much anything that floats, and drag it about 40 feet behind the boat and just keep the cameras focused on it. And fairly regularly, a great white shark would come up and hit that and just burst up out of the water. And to be 40 feet away from 14 or 15 feet of 2 or 3,000 pounds of great white shark traveling at 25 miles an hour, essentially a Volkswagen coming out of the water, and watching that happen is something that you will never, ever forget seeing, and you will take with you always. And they are just the most magnificent creatures I've ever seen in my life. And if I could go back there every year, whether it was for work or for play, I would do that, because they are just amazing, amazing animals and well worth the time that we spend on them.
Wow, that's amazing. There's lots of sharks coming into the U.S. coast right now because of the global warming, right?
There seem to be more sharks, at least reported. I know we've had a few attacks here in the Carolinas in the last few months. I think if people really knew how many sharks are there in the water, they'd be surprised, because it's an awful lot. We were out diving last weekend, and we went to a wreck to specifically dive with sharks, and we spent two dives swimming around with 8- and 9-foot sand tiger sharks, and there were probably 50 or 60 of them that I could count where I was swimming, and I was within literally touching distance of them, because sometimes we bump into each other while I was shooting video of them. And I'll be back out this next weekend to do the same thing. So, as I say, sharks are one of my favorite things, and when combined with shipwreck, it's hard to believe. And like I said, just they're magnificent animals, and I think they get a bad rap because they're animals like anything else, and they're by and large not dangerous. The problem, though, is that when a shark tries to figure out if you're food or not, it can usually be catastrophic for you. The shark just doesn't know that.
Now, so switching subjects here, conservationists, I've always wanted to know, like, you know, you've got the conservationists who go out there looking for these shipwrecks, and then you have the treasure hunters who are also out there looking for the shipwrecks. What is your opinion on that? Because with treasure hunters, there really isn't conservation. It's all about the money. What is your take on that?
Well, there's always been tension between the archaeological community and the treasure hunting community, for just some of the reasons you outlined. Because the archaeological community wants to do a very methodical recovery and make sure that they understand all the context of the shipwreck. And by and large, the treasure hunting company wants to get at the shiny yellow stuff, the valuable stuff, as quick as possible, and make money and move on. So I think both sides have good arguments against the other, and certainly treasure hunters have not made it any better for themselves over time. In the case of the Queen Anne's Revenge, which was found by a treasure hunting company, Intersal did the one amazing thing that treasure hunting companies never do. They agreed with the archaeologists and conservators and said, you know, you're right. Let's do this the right way. And they handed over to the wreck, the wreck to the state of North Carolina so that it could be properly conserved and become a cultural treasure of the people of North Carolina. In exchange, they kept the media rights and replica rights. And so I think that's probably the perfect example of where treasure hunters and archaeologists can work together. Because both did the right thing and for the right reasons, and I know that Intersal very much wanted to make sure that the whatever was recovered from the Queen Anne's Revenge was done in an archaeologically sound manner, and that that was important to them because the history was important. And I think in that case it should be a win-win for both sides. That may or may not be true in a lot of other cases, but at least on the Queen Anne's Revenge, that was the intent when the wreck was first found.
Well, that's pretty good. And hopefully we can get to see more arrangements like that, because that does make it into a win-win situation.
It does.
So now, you are so passionate about the work that you do. Do you find it harder to find, you know, fascinating projects like the Blackbeard or shark projects?
Well, it's always difficult because, I mean, obviously things like the Mardi Gras and the Blackbeard and V25, those are, they're fairly uncommon. But it also, I do happen to be in a circle where I would have information about projects like that that are coming along or a possibility. And so that helps improve my odds. So it's really a matter of, you know, each project that you do often leads to the next one through either people you met or information you've gained or that sort of thing. I got the call for the Mardi Gras project because of my work on the Queen Anne's Revenge project. And so it's, like I like to say, it's sheer dumb luck, but as a dear old friend of mine, a reporter I used to work with, used to say, it's better to be lucky than good, just be good enough to know when you're lucky. And so I am perfectly happy to take advantage of that luck when it comes along and make something out of it.
Now, how do we get a hold of you? What is your website, and how do people contact you?
The easiest way to find me and find out what I do is go to my company website, which is NautilusProductions.com. All you have to remember is it's like the Seashell or Captain Nemo ship. So NautilusProductions.com will lead you to all the things I'm involved in my website and my stock footage licensing and projects and whatever else I happen to be doing at the time.
Great. And what's next for you now? Like, what are you working on right now?
You never know. I'm waiting on the phone to call, the phone to ring. actually, technology keeps changing, and I've been selling and licensing stock footage for over 20 years now. When I first started out, we were shooting standard definition DV cameras, and now the stock footage world wants 4K ultra-high definition footage. So it seems that every about 10 years, I have to pretty much start over collecting footage again. And so I've started work pretty much collecting footage of sharks and shipwrecks and other subjects in 4K for ultra-high definition licensing. And so that's an ongoing project. And whenever I'm off the coast here diving with the sharks, I've always got a camera with me and building a new library to deal with the new technology that we face every few years.
Well, Rick, this is a wrap for our show. I want to give you a big thank you for being on our show. I really do appreciate it. And if anybody wants to get a hold of Rick, you know, you can go to his website. And Rick, repeat that website address again.
It's NautilusProductions.com. And thank you, Michelle. It's been a great pleasure.
Yeah, so, and if you would like to have questions about this program or the Cool Project Show.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.